This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Private Equity Podcast. I am thrilled today to be joined by Steve Darrington. Steve is the Chief Financial Officer and one of the partners of Phoenix Equity Partners. He'll talk to us about Phoenix Equity Partners. He'll talk to us a little bit about his career, about his advice for CEOs, CFOs, investors, and more. Steve, can you take a moment to introduce yourself?
Hi. Steve Darrington, I'm partner CFO at Phoenix, where I have been for just under 20 years. It's my 20th anniversary next June, although I actually kind of came together with the guys having been chief executive of a sort of joint venture portfolio company when I lived in New York. We're a relatively small half a billion fund size at a time. We're currently running two funds with a third looking forward to next year, based in the UK, investing in UK domicile businesses. Although they may trade all over the world, they need to be headquartered in the UK.
It's sort of amazing that in today's world, you mentioned half a billion. The number you mentioned is a relatively small number, but of course, you know, not that long ago, you know, $500 million was a lot of money. You know, at what point did it get to the spot that $500 million seemed like not so much money?
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, actually. And certainly during the 20 years I've been kind of sitting on this side of the fence, having been on the other side of the fence prior to that in my career, it depends who you're talking to. But, I'd probably say, you know, in the first 5 years, 2001, 2005 period, we were sort of very much mid-market. We have chosen to, we know the space that we work in, and we have chosen to stay in that space and have not sort of necessarily gone sort of out and out for funds under management. We like to refer to it as quality, not quantity. But I guess sometime in that, you know, in that 2010 period, we suddenly went from being mid-market to lower mid-market. So I guess it was around that time that the mega funds started to appear in, you know, 3, 4, 5. It just went very, very quickly. You know, 3, 4, 5, 7, 10 billion plus were at the top end of the market.
And you start to see now, like the Blackstones with literally hundreds of billions under management and funds that have $12 billion thought of as like a private debt fund we work with has $12 billion under management. And that's no longer thought of as such a crazy number. And at one time it was. Talk for a moment. I'll digress for one second. You're in the UK. Boris Johnson is sort of a folk hero to some, not liked by others. You know, you don't have to give a political stance on it. But to some, he seems like just this magnificently fascinating, fun leader and smart. Others, he seems, you know, half insane and so forth and too far right. But what's the sense of it that you hear there? Do people generally Boris Johnson fans or what's the sense you get?
Well, I think I have quite a few personal reference points with Boris via people I know who've worked with him directly. But I think that the easiest way for me to describe my own personal, in inverted commas, relationship with him is 5 years ago, we got a puppy, and he was a blonde buffoon running around bumping into things. And there was absolutely no name he could possibly be named other than Boris. He was an absolute cut and paste version of the man himself. And we named him Boris because Boris was very affectionately thought of through the country. I think I can probably trace back to the moments where Boris decided to lead the Leave Europe campaign, where he then became, certainly in my opinion and in many others' opinion, a very divisive individual. And there was there was definitely a winners and losers culture around that vote in the Europe to leave the European Union. And then that has polarized politics going forward. So as a result, I think he's very much now become a doom. People that love him continue to love him. I mean, there's a gentleman on your side of the water that's got a not wildly dissimilar profile. But there is increasingly a very significant amount of people that don't like him. I also think he's definitely not a man for a pandemic or a national crisis. I think one of the things that we have seen is a lack of grip. And he because it's not in his nature. He's very much a he's not a detailed guy. He's a sort of big speeches type of guy. We certainly in this country, and I guess the world this year, have been in a place where we've really, really needed detailed focus and action, and those that have done that have benefited significantly.
Fascinating perspective, and I apologize for catching on a political question. Just a fascinating individual. In some ways, he's sort of a less divisive figure than President Trump is. I think Boris Johnson does bring out some of that, but to a much lesser degree in terms of the amount of here. You either have there's a percentage on the left that just hates President Trump. There's a percentage on the right that just loves President Trump. And then there's a lot of people that are somewhere in between. It's sort of fascinating to watch. And I apologize for asking the question. He's just such an interesting individual and fascinating. I did not know, that you had named the dog Boris, or would have made it even that much more fortuitous a question. Talk about Phoenix Equity Partners and a few points of pride in Phoenix Equity Partners, and I'll bring us back to the core of the podcast, I promise.
I think what we all do in private equity is broadly similar. We kind of come at things from slightly different angles, but at the end of the day, the exam question we're set is very similar. I think the thing that we do, that we believe we do particularly well, is two key areas. One is we believe we have a genuinely world-class source investment sourcing capability. And that's which we call our origination team. And over the last 5 years, it's always been a badge of honor, but we have really applied a great deal of intellectual firepower and technology firepower, artificial intelligence, to building systems that allow us to monitor our environment or potential targets, which are, between 2,000 and 3,000 companies, and literally be alerted to quite small changes in every single one of those companies through dashboards and through data feeds that can feed directly to executives' desktops, so they can be aware of, they may be tracking 100 companies, they can be aware of quite small, but nevertheless relevant changes to those companies, creating opportunities to reach out to congratulate a CEO on an award or a new hire or a new market or something like that, to create a dialogue and also and to make it very clear to these companies that we are interested in what they're doing, we're watching what they're doing, and that they they're an important part of we believe in our future. We've identified them as interesting companies that are doing a great job, and I think that's providing us with an opportunity to genuinely get something that is much talked about, but much harder actually to prove, is primary deal flow, is the ability to have relationships with companies a long time in advance of any sale process, and to be able to sort of prosecute a principle of we look at the companies we want to buy, not necessarily the companies that are currently for sale. We're willing to wait. We're willing to do a lot of work, put a lot of intellectual effort into understanding the businesses, the pluses, the minuses, the opportunities and threats, and making ourselves known to the management. So when they do get to a point or a size or relevant trigger point, with their business, they're ready to talk to us, and they remember the fact that we put in the spade work, we put in the groundwork to make sure that we're a good business partner. And that brings me on to the second thing, which is winning the hearts and minds of those business owners. I think gone are the days when the private equity folks show up and they're the important people in the room because they've got the checkbook. Now it's the management team. They know there are probably 15, 20, 30, 40 private equity firms that could very, very easily be sitting across that table in exactly the same way as we are. And I believe, and we call it win work. I believe we are excellent at being able to win the hearts and minds of management teams and really make it clear that we get the fact that this is their business, and that it is their, often their life's work. It could be a family business. They are hugely invested in it physically, emotionally, and financially, and that we need to be people who can work with them to make that an ongoing success. So I think those two things allow us to, and I think that isn't it? It's a benchmark of what you need to be in private equity. Now, you need to be smart, agile, informed, and able to genuinely team with entrepreneurs, because they are the driving force.
You're fascinating. And take one moment. Magnificent points on sort of really letting the companies, the leaders, picking great leaders, and letting them continue to run the companies, and also on sourcing of deals and the strength of having a long-term perspective on building relationships on companies you want to buy and be a part of, not necessarily companies that want to sell and looking for partners. A magnificent perspective. Talk for a second about any advice that you would give to either investors or CEOs. What advice do you give to people approaching these businesses?
From a CEO perspective, I'm in the fortunate position is in my previous life I was the CFO of a business that, you know, one of the teams who is now my partner at Phoenix was on the board of, and I came in as a sort of a CFO, but not a private equity specialist CFO, and worked with them for a number of years in New York in the clinical trials business. I've got experience, and previous to that, I was in technology in the US as well, and I have plenty of experience of being on the other side of the table, where you're the portfolio company and you've got the private equity people on your board and working with you. And so having switched around now and worked with Phoenix, we've done over 50 deals in our 20 years working together. It's kind of one thing that two things, but they're sort of the different sides of the same coin. One is private equity. We're not terribly good at surprises. You know, at a push, we'll accept upside surprises. They're okay, but downside surprises are sort of difficult to handle. And I think downside surprises only tend to happen when the communication lines between the private equity group and the CEO, or often the CFO, break down. And then there's a feeling of of judgment, of sort of people looking over your shoulder. I think it's so critical for any CEO to establish a genuine open line of communication. We work incredibly hard to try and make sure that there's no defensive posture in any of the businesses we work with. We don't want to create an environment where anyone would choose to take that posture. What we want is open communication, honesty. And, you know, if you're facing a problem, we want to know about it, not because, you know, we want to judge the fact, but we want to help. We've got a lot of experience. We have a thing which we call the bench, which is lots of expertise that we can call on in certain circumstances. It's not a one size fits all, but over 20 years of dealing with all sorts of different opportunities and challenges within portfolio companies, we've met a lot of people, and we've met a lot of experts that can really help in situations. But they can't help if you don't, if you're not aware and you don't have a willingness, to bring a team in to sort out a situation or improve a situation or sometimes just to accelerate an upside opportunity. So it's communication and trust. It's very, very simple to say, but actually quite hard to prosecute over time.
Fantastic. Stephen, I want to congratulate you on just a magnificent career and the great success your funds have had, and your great leadership as a CEO prior to being with Phoenix Capital, Phoenix Equity Partners, and mostly on hopefully the continued health of Boris the dog, as well as Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister.
Well, I've got to unfortunately tell you, poor old Boris, he didn't make it. He really was a buffoon, and unfortunately when he was 18 months old, he ran into a tree and he unfortunately killed himself. So Boris didn't make it, but we have Boris's younger brother, Casper, nowadays. And so it's kind of the circle of life.
And who is Casper named after?
Casper's named after, it would seem, the friendly ghost. The male people in our family weren't too keen on it, but I'm outnumbered by females in my family, and they told me I had no further input into the naming of dogs after Boris.
This is almost often the way of the world, that at some point we run out of our ability to make decisions and so forth, and this is life. But it's a circle of life, as you said. What a great story. Steve, thank you for joining us on the Becker's Private Equity Podcast today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure.